somebody asked me to interview Tai, what does sadhu mean? It means it's well, it's good, wonderful. It's always nice to say that, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Well, here comes a question time. I hope there's some amusing ones today, because sometimes in meditation retreats, after 2 or 3 days, sometimes the honeymoon period is over. And people need a bit of fun and games, a bit of joy to actually put into meditation. One of the things I was very impressed with when I went to see monks like my teacher Ajahn Chah was just how happy they were and how they were willing to play around and have fun and games sometimes. And I realised that lightheartedness, that joyfulness is an important part of meditation. Without that happiness and joyfulness, sometimes one gets so serious, and that seriousness makes the mind so heavy, it's impossible to get into these beautiful meditation states. So we do find ways and means of bringing joy into the mind. In the same way that when you were at school, every morning and afternoon you used to have playtime. It's important to it's important to have playtime, because otherwise you get so serious. And when you're so serious, the children can't learn anything. So just give 15 minutes of playtime. And then afterwards, the kids are really ready to come into the meditation afterwards and really do the work. So I think for the next retreat, which is in November, I'll see if I can talk the Redemptorist Monastery to putting a few swings and stand here.
Pretty good stuff.
So good on our playtime. Okay, let's see what the first question is about. Here we go. Ajahn, whenever we are faced with new situations beyond our comfort zone, we often experience fear. Sometimes this fear is a protective mechanism to warn us of danger ahead, and sometimes it's just a fear of the unknown, in growing personally, just a fear of the unknown in growing personally, past our previous limitations. What did the Buddha teach that would help us distinguish whether to go forward to growth or to withdraw from danger? How to recognize and deal with these two sorts of fear, one which is to be faced and gone through and one which is to be taken as a healthy sign to back off? Yes, sometimes it's nice to actually understand where fear comes from, and you can actually say that all fear comes from the threat of losing something you're attached to. That's what really fear is. If you get a little lump in your breast or a little pain somewhere, you think, ah, I'm losing my health, I'm losing my life, this could be cancer. It's all fear of losing something which you think belongs to you. Really, your life doesn't belong to you, your body doesn't belong to you, this is, belongs to nature. Whether you're afraid or you're not afraid, one day it's going to be taken away from you. The same that, you know, are we afraid of losing our life? I remember one occasion, when I was a young monk in Thailand, going in a bus from one place to another, it was very wonderful that, you know, I couldn't read Thai that time. I could speak Thai, I could understand Thai, but I couldn't read it. Because in the newspapers, the last couple of days before this happened, there was all these incidents of buses catching fire. And sometimes actually people had died in these fires, they'd lost a lot of their possessions. One of the monks in my monastery had had to evacuate from one of the buses very quickly, and he lost all his goods. So I was travelling one of these buses, and then there was a commotion at the back. There was smoke coming out. So the bus driver, he put the brakes on and screeched to a halt. He went out the window. And all the other people, they rushed to the front and crowded out. And even there was a monk sitting next to me, and he rushed out as well. For me, I didn't know what was going on. What's a big problem? And so I just sat there, just like, you know, because I was basically, it wasn't courageous, I was just stupid. I didn't know what was happening. But, now I just sat there, and everyone else was out the bus. And then, you know, there's one person actually stayed behind, and it was just a cigarette that just caught something on fire. So he put it out and said, it's all right, we're not a bus fire, we're not going to explode. And because I was sitting there, you know, I wasn't trying to get out. I didn't look afraid. All the people came into the bus after and said, "Oh, Saadi, you're such a great man." I really like that. I didn't tell them, I didn't know what was going on, so what the heck? So a lot of fearlessness is actually stupidity. You know what's happening. But nevertheless. But people are afraid of losing their things or losing their life, and that's why we're afraid. When you come to like a new experience, you know, come here, sometimes that's natural. You don't sleep so well the first day because it's a new situation. But overcoming fear, you familiarise yourself with your room, you familiarise yourself with the retreat centre, with the people who are here, and after a while you get comfortable and it's, you know, relaxing the place. So like familiarity is one great way of overcoming fear. Even like the in those monasteries in Thailand, some of the things which would crawl over you at night, you know, like big spiders, tarantulas. At first, you know, people were very afraid of those things, but after a while you got used to them. Just a tarantula doing its own thing, that's all, it doesn't, can't eat you. So, you know, they'll just, you know, go over you at night time, you know, this little beak going over you. But after a while you got used to it, you got familiar with it. And so you weren't afraid anymore. And it's just like that, you see snakes all over the place. And you got familiar with them, you know, you look after, you don't tread on them on purpose, you don't play with them. But you become familiar with them. And there's many people who live in these places. They never get, they just get comfortable. They overcome fear with familiarity. And so a lot of our fear is just over-protection, and it's overcome with getting to know what's happening and becoming familiar there. I make that point because there is a time in your meditation you become afraid. You become afraid of being at peace. You're not really used to being at peace. And because you're afraid, you can't be at peace. You just withdraw. I think I'm ready for this. Sometimes even happiness and bliss, which comes up in the meditation, sometimes it comes up so strong. You think, this is a bit too much for me. Maybe for those monks and sister up here, but not for me. And you're afraid of it. But after a while, you become familiar with bliss. A lot of times that you get afraid because you're losing control in meditation. You're supposed to lose control. Let go. Doing nothing. But that's very fearful. That's one of the biggest fears, of actually losing control. You're not really losing control. You're deliberately letting go of control. Very much, it's like a simile which I gave years ago. Meditation is like you're driving in your car through heavy traffic, and Ajahn Brahm tells you to take your hands off the wheel, take your feet off the pedals, see what happens. You think, I'm going to crash! I'm going to wreck my car! Something's going to go terribly wrong! It will if you actually follow that simile through literally and you're in a heavy traffic. But if you do that with your mind, you just really let go of all this controlling. Take your hands off the steering wheel of your mind. Take your feet off the pedals. And just let go. You find you don't crash. But at first you're so afraid. Oh, we can't do this. If I don't control my mind, leading into this fantasy or that thought, if I don't really push this meditation, I just fall asleep, I waste my time. That's all fear. But part of my job is to overcome that fear for you by just encouragement, by having a bit of like confidence, faith, that it's worthwhile doing, that you can let go and that nothing will go wrong. Sometimes people even afraid of coming to a meditation retreat. They think, if you make your mind empty, the terrible spirits are going to come in and take you over. But my mind has been empty for such a long time and no terrible spirits are coming to see me. Do I look like I'm possessed? Or these other monks here look like they're possessed? Of course not. So that there's no danger in meditation. Usually what people say, is there any danger in meditating? I say there's lots of danger in not meditating. There's much more danger in not meditating. You get angry, you get upset, you get stressed out, you don't live very long. That's the danger. So there's nothing to fear. A lot of the time, that even like so-called healthy fear is, you know, sometimes goes overboard. We just get tense when we get afraid. when we get tense, we don't really respond appropriately. Sometimes in dangerous situations, people freeze and they can become completely incompetent through fear. So sometimes the even so-called healthy fear can be unhealthy. If instead it should be fear, it should be like this wise, seeing there's a problem there, the potential problem, and sort of very carefully, very coolly taking evasive action. I don't know if that really qualifies as being called fear. It's just, you know, just wisdom, that's all. You see a snake, you don't get afraid of it. Because if you get afraid, sometimes the snake realizes you're afraid, and the snake gets afraid, the both of you get afraid. I remember stepping on a snake once in my monastery. It's a monastery in the north of Thailand. It was just in front of the door. So when I opened the door, my vision was just a foot in front of the snake. So I didn't realize I'd trodden it until I felt this big cold thing under my soles of my foot. So I jumped one direction, and fortunately the snake jumped the other direction. And then we looked at each other, and I said, sorry. And so the snake just went away. That's all that happens. I remember one day, even worse than that, this is my snake stories now. Worse than that, one morning in this forest in the jungle, we stayed up all night meditating. And it was at dawn. I thought it was light enough, I could see where I was going. But I went out to have a urinate in the bushes. It was a jungle monastery. I urinated on this twig. And then the twig started moving. It wasn't a twig, it was a snake. No. And I think I was wasn't at all afraid because you were so tired and sleepy. Oh, what's that? I was too sort of dull to be afraid. And of course I apologised afterwards. And afterwards, somebody, I mentioned that some time ago, and sometimes they said, oh, that snake was probably very happy, got some holy water. Not many snakes get blessed with a... So, be careful of fear and find out why are you afraid. And sometimes even so-called healthy fear can be unhealthy. You can overreact to the problem, and when you overreact to the problem, you tense up and you don't act appropriately. When you've got nothing to lose, you're not afraid anymore. It's marvellous when you've got nothing to lose. You're free. You become fearless. Especially in your meditation, you've got nothing to fear, you've got everything to enjoy. When bliss comes along, just go for it. And if you can't actually go for it, you can do that how a child learns how to not be afraid of water. A little kid just learned how to walk on dry land and stand up straight after a lot of falling over. And now you take it to the swimming pool. Imagine for a little child, that's so scary. You can't stand on that water. So what did the child do? Put the little toe in first of all. Come back again. That's not so bad. Then put the whole foot in. That's okay. Then put a bit of leg in. Take it out again. So it feels safe. So you just go gently into what you're afraid of, then you come back again, see what it's like. And after it's put its whole leg in, then it jumps in. And with a swimming pool, especially on a hot day, once a child jumps in, it's so hard to get it out again. It's having such a wonderful time. And that's like the deep blissed meditation. You put a little toe in there first of all, and you draw back again. What was that like? Oh, that sounds really nice. Next time you put your whole foot in, and you draw it back again. Then it may be a leg, and then you jump in. And you can't get you out of that bliss, even for lunch. You're staying there having a great time. So that's actually how we face fear. The other time we face fear, especially the fear of that bliss which comes up in meditation, sometimes it looks so powerful, you're so afraid of it, but ooh, it's just too nice, what the heck, and you just go through it. Sometimes joy overcomes fear. Just the power of happiness. Oh, what the heck, I'm going to go through it. Again, all fear is about thinking you've got something to lose. It's like, the fear of public speaking. You think you're going to lose your reputation. I don't know what my reputation is now. I think I lost it years ago, so you can't lose your life. And that's it, it's gone. You just have a good time. Is there any questions about that one? Okay, next question, here we go. I seem to get stuck in emptiness. No breath. It disappears, no body gone, space that is vast, boundless, Even go back to breath. No nimitta appears, however. What's wrong? Okay. Why not say, what's the problem there? If you get nice emptiness, it's beautiful. Enjoy the emptiness. But sometimes we think we want something more. And that's what's wrong, wanting something more, not being satisfied. So if it's that you're in emptiness, allow the emptiness just to be. So what's wrong with emptiness? What do you want? What's more? And it's the wanting which is wrong. So as I said this morning, just what you're experiencing is not the point, it's how you're experiencing it. So if you're experiencing emptiness and you want something more, then that's the problem. If you're experiencing a wandering mind, it's all over the place, but you're content with that, then you're going well. It doesn't matter what you're experiencing, it's how you're experiencing it. But deeper than that, it's actually, what's happening is, if there's no breath, it appears, it's emptiness, you need to put a bit more energy into that emptiness. And that's actually where you brighten up the mind with bliss. Because you can be still, and that's nice and empty. It's got no oomph behind it, it's got no power behind it. And that means it doesn't get really into the deep states of meditation. So what I usually tell people to do is that when you are, say, watching the breath, don't let that breath go until it's so nice and so beautiful. So it's what the Buddha actually said in the fifth and sixth stages of Anapanasati, the meditation on the breath, how the Buddha taught it. Breathing in, breathing out, you develop pity, this joy. Breathing in, breathing out, you develop sukha, happiness. You deliberately develop that. You find ways of making the mind happy and beautiful and lovely and wonderful. You look for the happiness. It's there if you really look for it. But sometimes, because you know, we're not really looking, we don't find it. So you make this breath so nice and so wonderful. This is why I called it the beautiful breath. You do that before the breath disappears. Make the mind just so lovely. So wonderful. Little ways of doing that, you can play games like imagine that this breath is coming from all the flowers and the trees. That's where the oxygen comes from. So every time you breathe in, it's a gift from all that's green and wonderful in the world. When you breathe out the carbon dioxide, that's what the flowers in the garden need. Without the carbon dioxide, they won't be able to. So when you breathe out, it's your gift to nature. So you're breathing in as nature's offering to you oxygen. You're breathing out your gift of carbon dioxide for the plants and the flowers. So every time you breathe in, it's connecting you with the garden outside. Every time it's breathing out, you're part of that garden outside. And then the breath starts to get really nice and interesting. It starts to get beautiful. Then the breath becomes lovely and wonderful. So you play around with this breath. And the other thing you can do with the breath is look upon the breath as like your child, like a little baby. Those of you who haven't had babies yet, you can just imagine this is beautiful little baby. And you're holding this baby with kindness, with love, with care. Wonderful thing like with love, it always gives you happiness. Whatever you love, you get fun out of, you get joy out of. You know, that I can't imagine it myself because they bring the babies to the monastery and they're crying and they're peeing and I can't see how they can. But the mother is doting on this little baby and all the other people, oh, isn't it so sweet, isn't it so sweet? Maybe I've been a muck for too long, I don't know. But anyway, I know that mothers love babies. So look upon your breath as being your baby. This wonderful little baby, breathing out like rocking the baby. Now, if you look upon your breath as a baby, if you have a baby, would you ever go to the shopping mall, drop your baby somewhere, and not remember where you left it? So that's what you do with the breath. You're watching the breath, breathing in, breathing out, you just go somewhere else, and you don't know where you left the breath. You dropped it somewhere, and you can't remember. That's because you don't care about it. You don't love it. If you put like love into the breath, oh, this lovely, beautiful breath. Oh, and it's just so sweet, and so tender. And just it comes in, just so soft, and just goes out. Oh, it's so full. Then when you start to love the breath, it's so easy to watch and it's fun to watch. It does become a beautiful breath. You could go in, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in. How long do we have to do this for? I've got 6 days to go, breathing in, oh God. So if you look at the breath like that, no way you're going to be able to watch the breath. And also, if the breath disappears, it's still, but it's not beautiful. So you make the breath beautiful. After a while it becomes like, towards the end of the retreat, your energy start coming out. Whatever you look at becomes beautiful. Food becomes beautiful. Even the, as the retreat goes on, even the jokes become funnier. It's nothing to do with the joke. You've got a bright mind. So this is actually what we do. We put energy and beauty into that breath. So when it disappears, the beauty is left. And that's the energy of the mind. And when that energy comes up, the mind is brilliant. And that's where you see nimittas. And you get really powerful energies coming up. And those are the great ones. That's where you do get bliss. And this is what you're supposed to get. So enjoy it when the energies start coming up. Look for happiness. Little trick while you're meditating. This is a little trick which I've been developing. While you're meditating, if the breath is nice and peaceful, but there's no happiness coming up, for 1 or 2 seconds, take the attention away from the breath, put it on your face. Just, you know, be aware of your facial muscles. And smile. Make a smile. Force one. When you force a smile, straight away, that makes the mind beautiful. It's just a bit, you know, as the body affects the mind affects the body. They're intertwined. So when actually you put a little smile on your face, that brightens up the mind and the breath becomes a little bit more beautiful. It's one way in which as a teacher you can actually see how people's meditation is going. They're gritting their teeth. They realise that they're not getting very far. If they've got a horizontal mouth, again, that's better than gritting their teeth, but they're still not sort of getting it. But then you see a few people that are sitting with this wonderful silly smile on their face. Ah, now they're enjoying it. So put that little smile on your face when you're meditating. Just take your attention away from the breath for a few seconds. Put it on the face and smile. Make a smile. And then go back to the breath and you find the breath is more beautiful. You just made it more happy. And see if you can keep on with that. To look for the happiness in the breath, and it gets happy, 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 happy. That's how you can do it. Easy. Okay, so it's the happiness that's not there. You need to get more happiness to get that stillness, just vibrating with power. And that's where nimittas come. Any comments on that one? Okay, next question. Oh, yes?
We look at cocktailing of the breath and breathing in the flowers.
Yeah.
Then your breath gets deeper and longer?
Oh yeah, because what you're doing, you're making it interesting, and with interesting the mind engages much more, and so your mindfulness becomes stronger.
So and you hold on longer to the breath?
Yeah, it's easier. The whole thing is much easier when you make it fun. Now, I used to be a school teacher, and one of the things I was taught, make the lessons fun, and then the children pay attention, they learn more. And you know, that's, you know, one of the reasons why I tell jokes. Well, I give talks, make it fun, and people learn more. It's, you know, it's a very common teaching technique. Because when it's fun, we want to pay attention. It engages the mind. And this is what happens when you're meditating. Otherwise, you just get bored out of your mind just watching the breath. That's another 6 days. It doesn't become fun. So you make it fun, make happiness come in, and all this becomes lovely. And you really enjoy every minute of this retreat. Same with the food. You know, taste it, enjoy that food. And then when you actually enjoy it, it becomes fun. And because you enjoy it, all the saliva and the bile and the other sort of, you know, stuff comes out of your digestive system, and you digest it well. But if you just shove food down your mouth and you're not really paying attention to what you're eating, then just it's nature. Just all those juices don't get secreted. And you don't digest things well. So when you're eating, just enjoy that food. When you're meditating, enjoy the meditation. Put joy in there. and pray around to find joy. And do things strange ways. If you're getting bored breathing, then do the breathing backwards meditation. This is the original Ajahn Brahm technique, not in the books. I don't know any other teacher who's taught this, breathing backwards. You know how to breathe backwards? Some of you do know this. You breathe out first, then you breathe in. You try it, I call it breathing backwards. You breathe out first, then you breathe in. It's completely different. So, you do your out-breath first, then you do the in-breath. Then you watch your out-breath, then you watch the in-breath. Then watch the out-breath first before you watch the in-breath. I call it breathing backwards. And it's just perception, but it actually works. You're just messing around, you're playing around with these things, and it makes it more fun. If you do walking meditation, just walk backwards. Or walk sideways. Or, do like, Monty Python? Funny walks. Make it fun, put joy into it, and then you'll be being not zombies anymore. These explain the three superior or inferior roots of karma. When one does a good deed, right intention, action, etc. Since an arahat does not generate any more karma for future rebirths, does that mean all his or her actions have no superior or inferior roots? Thank you. Oh, this is the deep question. Superior and inferior roots. I just know the roots of karma is like, I suppose, inferior roots. It's greed, hatred and delusion. It's like desire or ill will or stupidity. You don't know really what you do. And that's the roots of bad karma. And the biggest one is that delusion, stupidity, ignorance. You don't really know what you're doing. That's why a lot of times people make bad karma. They haven't got a clue what they're doing. They're harming themselves and they're hurting others. Who in their right mind would ever harm themselves or hurt others? No one in their right mind could do that. That's why when a person is wise, you just can't do bad things. It's impossible to do. You can't sort of tell anybody else off. You can't tell a lie. It's impossible to do it. You can't sort of call another person sort of camel face. Except it's a joke, though. That's what I have to do. But you can't have it because why would you do that? Why would you make enemies? This makes no sense. But when you're deluded, you can do anything. The stupidest things. And that's what delusion is. You have like desire and craving. And desire and craving is complete delusion. And you want to be happy by getting that food. I think of the food you're missing this evening. If you sneak out there, there's probably a deli just around the corner. See, that's desire. If you do that, you're just creating more problems for yourself. You just get really guilty, you feel really bad afterwards. You don't really need it anyway. So all that desire and craving just creates problems for you. When you let go of craving, you're free. Then you're happy. It's all this craving business, why people do it. Because it's all just not seeing the truth of things, not really seeing what happiness truly is. The same with ill will. Why would you want to hurt anybody or have ill will towards anything? Nobody's fault, people are just people, that's all. If someone talks, they're just people, that's all. You don't have ill will towards them. Just know you don't have ill will towards a child when they sort of, wet their pants or something. It's just a child being a child, what do you expect? So those are like the roots of bad karma, and the roots of good karma is the opposite of that. Instead of like greed, it's like giving. So liberality, being able to renounce things. It's not what I want, but what I can give away. It's like as a monk, you're always giving things away. You're a giver away, and you enjoy giving away. It's like even when, as a monk, you go on retreat, those personal retreats. Somebody puts food in your bowl. There's always a couple of kangaroos to find out which monks are on retreat. And you get much more fun giving the food to the kangaroos than you do eating it yourself. You get much more fun feeding others than you do feeding yourself when you really face it. It's so good actually to see someone enjoying a bit of food, even if it's a kangaroo. So you get much more fun giving than you do receiving. And that's the cause of good karma. Instead of like greed, what I want, what can I share with other people? You get much more fun that way. Instead of ill will, it's compassion, loving kindness, forgiveness. So someone really hurts me, and I forgive you. It's so much more fun, forgiving. Sometimes it really shocks the other person. What do you mean, you forgive me? Aren't you going to sort of hit me back or something? Say, nah, don't feel like it today. And that way, that they can't, it's a waste of time having ill will against you anymore. They might get angry at you and they call you names. And you don't react. If you don't react, it's no fun calling you names anymore. What's the fun of calling somebody, like donkey face? Where they sort of, all they do is laugh. I'm trying to get you upset. That's why we call each other names. So instead of ill will, we have compassion and forgiveness, and the whole thing stops there. Instead of delusion, we have wisdom, understanding, seeing things clearly. So if we have clear seeing, we have compassion, loving kindness, we have liberality, giving away, then that's the roots of good karma. So what are you doing this weekend? Or this week? You're developing the roots of good karma. You're developing wisdom, clear seeing. You're just giving yourself to this meditation retreat. Not expecting anything, not trying to get something. And no ill will, just compassion all the way. So there you really are making huge good karma. The Buddha said if you give a donation of $1 billion, it's not worth a 60th part if you should take refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Take refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, it's not a 60th part of if you start to develop deep meditation. So what you're doing here, you're doing the good karma of multi-billionaire giving away all their money when you do meditation like this. So this is huge good karma. You can't do bigger karma than this meditation. If you do it properly, that is. You can mess around. And wasting opportunity. This anahata does not generate any more karma for future rebirth. Does that mean all his other actions have no superior or inferior? It might have like superior roots, because that's actually what an anahata does. They're just motivated by loving kindness, motivated by compassion, motivated by wisdom. That's why an anahata gets out of bed in the morning. Oh, my goodness. That was a different one. Hope you read out loud. Okay. Secret one. Next question. Oh, my goodness. No. This is an essay, not a question. Now, I know that what happens sometimes when people meditate a lot, their mind gets sort of very restless and they write a lot. It's called the punch of proliferation. Because it says, then Rajan Brahm said, let me seek your indulgence with this poetic question in verse. My Buddhist retreat here so far on the third day can from... I'll just read it out. I don't know if I can scan it properly. My Buddhist retreat here so far on the third day, counted from the 9th of April 2004, has given me a range of clarity of my human sense of hearing, vision, smell, taste and touch, almost nirvanic. Every sound or footfall or drag of footwear on grass or stone is increased. Every careless drop of cutlery is a sudden tenfold clang of cymbals. A rush of sudden whirlwind is someone rushing past you. Every leaf and every grass blade is a loud tint and hint of its variegated green. Every colour and every and hue of a flower explodes in your retina like its deepest inherent dye. Every smell of a flower, its greenery and bark of planted tree is rubbed hard against your nose scent. And every taste of food is crushed against your mouth and tongue, for it is food divine. And it is lovingly cooked by our expert chefs here. My My hydrochloric acid exudes ever more when every little pang of hunger is heard without my stomach walls. I waited this long, near my seventh decade, 2 years short of it, to sample life near its nirvanic bliss. Is it wrong to indulge or think, let alone write, of my plenitude of human pleasures here? Where's it go? Echoes dustbin, your Japanese friend, an ajahn. You asked me to let it go and surrender. Let it go for what to come, let it go of life or living. I could almost ask for another decade or two of living to enjoy this life. Is it wrong for a near septuagenarian to live life at its fullest? There you go. When winter comes, what will be spring in my next rebirth be like? I dare not ask for nirvana when autumn is full and glows like your robe. That's very nice. Sorry if I didn't read that out properly, because it needs to read it first of all before you can actually read out poetry to get an idea of what it's saying. But it is true that when you become peaceful in your meditation, the mind becomes clear, and so do the senses become clear. And many of you may know, like Japanese poetry, that many sort of Japanese monks, they write this beautiful poetry. And not only Japanese monks, in the time of the Buddha, the enlightened monks would write poetry about their achievements and also about the nature. And some of those poems, Ajahn Jethamala has translated, and we printed some in one of the journals recently. And these are all monks with such clear minds that whenever you, and nuns as well, that whenever they see nature, it's just so beautiful, so lovely. But they really enjoy it because they can let go of it. And whenever they try and catch hold of it, it's like plucking a flower and putting it in a vase. Eventually it just fades away. But if you leave it out there where it belongs, on the tree or in the bush, it stays for a long time. You can't really sort of capture the dewdrops. You just can enjoy them while they're there and let them go. The more one can let go and free nature, the more it shines. Which is why that, you know, as we meditate more and more, you can actually see deeper into things. As you see deeper into things, you can enjoy it. But it's all the enjoyment of letting go. When you try and own these things, then all the joy disappears. So when you're meditating, when you're seeing nature, when happiness comes, don't grasp onto it. Otherwise, you see the beautiful lotus flower and you just crush it. And you kill its life and its beauty. When it comes, just treat it gently. Allow it to come, allow it to delight you, and allow it to go at its own time. So the happiness in meditation is not yours. It's not yours to control. It's a gift which comes, you watch it, and allow it to come. If you try and capture it, then it's not a beautiful thing anymore. It's just like a bird in a cage. It dies because it doesn't belong in captivity. So enjoy nature, enjoy the moment, but don't try and capture it. Don't own it. Don't put it in a cage. Liberate it. And then it will delight you forever. I don't know if that makes sense. Anyway, thank you for that poem. Please explain what is jhana. How do we know if we are in jhana? For those of us who are still struggling, is it possible for Ajahn and the monks and Sister Ajahn to give us a helping hand by transmitting your energy to us? Just like what's starting to come. My goodness, what do you think I've been doing for the last It is actually true that I'll explain, I'll do a whole talk on jhanas later on during the retreat. But it is true that if one or two of the monks or sister gets into a deep meditation, then that actually creates an energy which pulls other people along as well. Because I've noticed that just in our range retreats we have in our monastery. And if one of the monks gets a deep meditation, quite a few other monks get at least a deeper meditation than normal the same night. As if it's like an energy, like a current, pulls people along.
Do they have to be close to each other there, or can they be in different huts?
Well, because the monastery is like a community, then there's like a connection there. So that seems to work. That seems to pull people along. So that's, you can do that. But really, it's your job, because we're each owners of our karma. that's just like borrowing, and borrowing a bit of something you don't really deserve. It does work, yes. But a little bit, it's like explaining what those jhanas are. And the best helping hand you can give is like, you know, the words, the encouragement, not so much the detail of the words, but where those words are coming from, the underlying theme, the letting go, enjoying the meditation, no fear, giving up control. That's where we get those deep states of meditation from. And by keeping on brainwashing you for 9 days, that's what I'm doing. Brainwashing in the morning, brainwashing in the evening. Eventually, the phone must get in there. And then it sort of, it works. I've got two questions, so I'm not going to answer them very quickly. Why is a nimitta of feeling difficult to enter a jhana, a feeling nimitta, difficult to enter a jhana with? Why are they harder to work with? I'll say more about that later on, but just in brief, like the feeling nimittas, they are solid enough to really work with. They can be strong, they can be weak. You haven't really got enough buttons there to press on them. And so because of that, sometimes they are much more difficult to use to get into the jhanas. Traditional way is to get those visual type nimittas up, and then there's so much you can do with them to be able to guide yourself into the jhanas. It's the difference between like a bicycle maybe and a Rolls Royce. You know, sort of one vehicle is much better to get you from one place to another. I notice, but I'll talk about nimittas in jhana in the talk in another couple of days. I notice that fruits aren't served at tea time. Does this mean that fruits are not allowed afternoon while fruit juice is alright? Yeah, that's true. If juice is okay because that's considered to be just like liquid refreshment. Fruits aren't. But this is just another rule. You've got to draw a line somewhere. And sometimes that line is a wavy line. So, you know, whatever, it's just how it's decided. So, don't be so concerned about what goes into your mouth. So, just, you know, if it's allowable, if it's on the table, then you can put it in. If it's not on the table, just don't worry about it. So, just like you have loving kindness, you can say, the door of my mouth. Whatever goes in, it goes in. Whatever can't go in, it doesn't go in. I can understand that contentment is the antidote to desire and craving, but how do you know when saying this is good enough is a cover up or an excuse for feeling undeserving of more and greater things? This is good enough is always good enough. So, a lot of times we complicate these matters and say, is it good enough? What am I doing this for? Is it because I'm undeserving? The thing is, that is the way to get the deeper states of meditation, through letting go. This is good enough. Then you're getting away from this thing we call the fault-finding mind. You can find fault with anything. The most beautiful food is not good enough. In one of the meditation centers in the United States, they put so much money into making this most beautiful, wonderful meditation center you could possibly build and imagine. It's a beautiful place. And then one day the manager said, how can we make this better? Let's have a complaints box. And they put a complaints box on there. And the first day it was full of complaints. They couldn't believe it. If you have this in a really gross meditation center, you know, it's really harsh, many people to a room, the food's not so good, you have to do lots of chores. You put a complaints box and there's hardly any complaints. It seems the closer you get to perfection, the more complaining you have. It's a strange thing. But here, we have, so this is good enough, just give up all those complaints. This really is good enough. You've got a human birth, you've got a nice place you can sit meditation. And what more do you want? When you say this is good enough, then it's letting go of craving. It's not saying deserving. You deserve to have a rest. You deserve to be free of the fault-finding mind. You deserve to actually to acknowledge that this is good enough. And you are good enough. You deserve to be. Have that said to you, you are good enough. When you say that, the problems disappear, the fear, the fault finding, the guilt, the lack of freedom. When you say you're good enough, you can leave prison. We're all in our prison of our craving and our ill will. But the thing with that prison, the gate, the door is always open. You can leave your cell whenever you want. But the thing is, we don't want to leave our cell. We've lived in that cell for so long that we're afraid to go outside and just say this is good enough. Or in the cell of craving and doing and controlling and stuff like that. So you just let go. Just walk it out and have some freedom. This is good enough. So you deserve to be free. That's why you deserve to say it's good enough. It's not letting go. It's not sort of, it is letting go. It's not sort of, what am I trying to say there? It's not sort of covering up any feelings of undeservingness. It's just completely abandoning all those feelings, all those conceits of I'm better, I'm worse, I'm the same. And just moving away from that world of having to do things. Someone has written a cartoon here. They've got two snails called Sloth and Torpor, and they've got I will die this for sure, I will die that for sure, and there's a big Buddhist foot about to stomp on both of them. I have an idea for a group activity, a walking meditation race. Whoever comes last wins. Whoever goes last. Okay. Next question. The person next door keeps on turning his basin tap on and off late at night or early in the morning, 10 or 15 times over a 20-minute sequence. At first it disturbed me, but following your advice not to let my mind go out to the noise, I calmed down and went to sleep again, accepting the fact that the person next door either has an obsessive compulsion to clean his teeth or has 15 times before bed, or he's doing the laundry. Or strange things. Not strange times. So. However, it did end there. I am now starting to have very strange dreams that I am trapped in an apartment house with a Chinese laundry next door. I'm getting lost in corridors, washing lines, white t-shirt, a wet towel. Is it the strong coffee I'm drinking? quite lucky. Okay, yeah. Because please remember that those wash basins you have in your rooms, they are very noisy and they reverberate, just because, you know, the pipes go down below, they go next door, and they do make a noise. So if you use it in the wash basins, like, you know, use them frugally and at the right times. And, you know, just turn on the tap, get some water, and then have done with it. So, but if someone is turning on that tap on and off, on and off, on and off, on and off. Just be kind to them. Just don't disturb. This afternoon I literally tried flat out meditation on my bed. I noticed that with the body totally relaxed it was so much easier to watch the bed. However, I didn't try for very long, so I wasn't sure if it were to be encouraged. Please kindly comment. If you really want actually to do the lying down meditation, don't do it close to your pillow. Because all pillows are magnetic. They draw you to them. And the thing is, in your bed, on your bed is where you sleep. And so psychologically it sort of tells you this is sleep time. And very often you fall asleep that way. So if you do a lie down meditation, do it on the side, away from your bed. And lie down in a different position. You can put sort of a few pillows there or a mat or something. And then do lying down meditation there. If it's not the usual place where you go to sleep, then chances are you won't go to sleep. If you do it where you usually, you know, nod off, then that's you're probably nod off. Just psychology, that's all. But it's true, because your body is relaxed, you know, and it feels good, then you don't have to worry about the body. That's why people actually like doing some lying down meditation. But you can do sitting down. Sitting down is very comfortable, you know, on one of the chairs. Or standing or walking is comfortable. But don't go around sitting for too long cross-legged and getting yourself all sore and painful. Because the meditation never works then. So as long as the body feels good, then that's good. After a really nice period of being in a blissed out state, I start to have a conversation. One half of me says, stay on, continue the meditation, while the other half says, you've got what you wanted, you can end the meditation now. Inevitably, I do come out of the sitting. What should I do? Shut up. So when you start having a conversation, just go, shh, and calm it down. Because that's what the thought is. The thought is, should I do it this way, should I do it that way? It starts to give you doubt, and it starts to get so, so difficult. In Thailand, when I was a young monk, sitting next to this monk, he had his bowl of food in front of him, and then he pushed it away. And he brought it towards him again. After a minute or two, he pushed it away again. Then he brought it towards him. What the heck are you doing? He said, you know, when I saw my food, I realized I was attached to it. So I decided to push it away. And as I pushed it away, I decided that was just pride. So I put it towards him. Absolutely stupid. That's what thought does. You know, should I eat it? Should I not eat it? If I eat it, that's giving into my desire. If I don't eat it, that's giving into my spiritual pride. Should I? It was crazy. Just eat it. So it's amazing just how complicated we can make it when we start thinking. And here, you know, they have that old story in Zen Buddhism about those two monks arguing because they saw a flag flying. And one of the monks said, no, the flag is moving, no, the wind is moving, no, it's the flag is moving, no, it's the wind which is moving. And they went to go and see the Zen monk and said, no, you're both wrong, it's the mind is moving. And then they went to go and see the Theravada monk and said, the three of you are wrong, your mouths move. Finish up. So this is what happens, we have this conversation with each other, and we're all with ourselves. And so if that happens, if the mind wants to carry on in the bliss, it's the mind's job. If the mind wants to come out, it's the mind's business. Your job is just to watch. So you just leave it alone. It's like there's a pilot in the plane, and you're just a passenger. You don't go and knock on the pilot's door and say, you know, can you sort of, you know, on the way to Singapore, do you mind going past, you know, sort of Bogor, you know, do a sort of few sweet slides so I can actually see. I've never seen Bogor before. Because, you know, the pilot's got his own job to do. So allow the mind wants to enjoy, let the mind enjoy. If the mind wants to come out, let the mind come out. You be quiet. And don't disturb the pilot. Throughout the whole day I was unable to switch off one verse of the chanting, Yadi Dang Shatari Purisa Yugani. Put my head on the pillow at the same time, first thing that came to my mind when I awoke. That was my meditation for the day. Oh, that's very nice. I heard that. Are you content with that? That means that is the four types of noble beings, the four types of enlightened ones. It's a very nice thing to think about, as long as you know what it means. So the four types of noble beings, the four types of noble beings, the four types of noble beings all day. Isn't that nice? So, if you're content with that, you're doing well. If you're not content with it, you want something else, then it's a problem for you. It's not what you're experiencing, it's how you're experiencing it. Here's the point. Next question. What is the Buddhist perspective on Reiki? Actually, that we really like that. That's an old joke, I won't say that. In our monastery, we have to Reiki leaves every day. We call that Reiki. What is the Buddhist perspective on Reiki? A hands-on healing process has its roots in markings on the Buddha's feet. They don't even know that. Its current form originated in Japan and is well marketed as an alternative complementary treatment for just about everything. Basically, if it works, go for it. Nothing wrong with it. If it works, why it works, I always think it's because of the power of the mind. Kindness, good mind states, and then that power of the mind. I already mentioned that chanting can heal people. So if it works, great, go for it. Transference of merits. Assumption. Illness is caused by several factors, one of which is karma. Someone is ill, I dedicate merits to him, he recovers. How the merits, one, eliminates bad karma, which causes illness, among other factors, or merely postpones bad karma. You have to experience the results in a future life. It's, if you've done some chanting or shared your good karma with somebody else and they recover from illness, it may be many, many causes, but that might be one of them. It's just like, you know, if you're watching a tennis match and you're cheering on the person, you know, who's playing, you know, it's your country. Your cheering on encourages them, and that's actually a contributing factor to their winning. You cheer somebody on. So life is such a thing called encouragement. And that helps. So actually we're encouraging somebody here by, you know, a very positive mood, positive energy towards them. Does it mean they have to, you're just postponing their bad karma until later? No, because okay, at the moment, maybe they've still got some bad karma. You can always change the bad karma. You can dilute it. It gives them a chance actually to work with it so it doesn't come up again. So it's always a good thing to do. Karma is always fluid. We've got lots and lots of bad karma to pay off. We've got lots and lots of good karma to pay off. And sometimes we can just postpone it, postpone it, postpone it. Sometimes that, you know, we become a stream with it before we have to pay it off. So we never have to pay it off then. It's just written off as like a bad debt. So there are ways of avoiding that bad karma, or other ways of diluting it. There are some bad karma you can't avoid, and that's the bad karma if you killed your parents and things like that. But there's a lot of karma you can sort of work with, you can avoid, you can dilute, and that is it's a good thing. So in other words, if you see someone who's ill, if you give them Reiki or you help them in all sorts of other ways, then that's a good thing to do. You make good karma and you allow them to share your good karma, and they get better, you get happier, and it's a win-win situation. If you see someone who's ill, don't say, "Ah, that's your bad karma. I'm not going to send you to the doctor. I'm not going to call an ambulance, because it's obviously your bad karma. You're sort of in a road accident like that. You're going to die, so six times you die." You get in big trouble that way. Do the Buddhists have a view regarding organ donation? There probably wasn't a lot of it going on in the Buddhist time. Actually, there was organ donation in the time of the Buddha. There was the nun. What was her name? Wajiri, was it? Wajiri, yeah. The nun Wajiri. And she was this Arahat nun, which is also very, very beautiful. And this young scallywag sort of saw her and became infatuated with her and followed her off into the forest and was about to rape her. He said, "Look, what do you want me for? And he said, can you marry me? You're just so beautiful." He said, "What do you mean I'm so beautiful? What's really beautiful? What's the most beautiful part of me you like?" "Oh, your eyes, your beautiful doe-like eyes. They're beautiful, are they?" He said, "Oh, they're just so wonderful." So she got her eye, pulled it out and gave it to him. It's amazing, actually, when you take the eye out of the socket and sort of, you know, give it to a person, it's not beautiful anymore. And at that, his lust completely disappeared. That's like the first organ donation. He gave an eye. And then he bowed down and asked forgiveness, and probably his lust disappeared in one go. Now that's what you really call monks. They were good monks. But apparently, when she went to see the Buddha afterwards, the Buddha used his psychic power and she got her eye back. One of the rare times that the Buddha used his psychic power especially to heal part of the body. So it's an organ donation. So I mean, you've got two eyes, you can spare one. And what is really beautiful? So that's why sometimes though you say, "You look up, your lips are so beautiful." Take them off and kiss them. But actually, what is it about life and design, all that sort of stuff? You've got such wonderful hair, beautiful hair. Cut it all off, here you go. If you like it so much, you can have it and become a nun. But someone told me that Buddhists disapprove and believe that it is that if, say, you die and donate your cornea, then you'll not be able to see in your next life. Oh, no, that's really stupid. If whatever you donate, you never lose by making good karma. If you actually give your cornea, or you give your heart, or you give your liver, or whatever you give in your next life, you know, you'll just, your livers, whatever you give, will just be really, really good. Or your eyes will be just so clear, because what you give is the law of karma. You're giving to somebody else. You're helping them. And with that sort of generosity, with that sort of beauty of spirit, you're letting go of your own concerns and giving to other people, you never ever lose. Every time somebody has, you know, like done a really great act of charity, really given to somebody else, they never lose. They always get much more back than what they've given. So many cases. This is one of the beautiful cases. That Sri Lankan monk, he was found to be like, he had, I think it was a kidney donation. And you know, he was contacted because his kidney matched somebody who needed a donor. The trouble was that the person who needed the donor was a born-again Christian. He was going around Sri Lanka converting all the Buddhists. She was one of these evangelists. So they asked him, and said, "Would you know, this is the only match we've got, would you mind giving your sort of kidney to a born-again Christian?" And he said, "Of course not. No worry at all. Take it." And so they did the operation. And so he gave his kidney, so a born-again Christian could win. And of course he got in the newspapers and said, "Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu, that's a real monk. You don't care who you give to, may all sentient beings be happy and well. Even if it was the man who raped my child, I can still give my kidney to him so he can survive." Now that's compassion. That's generosity. And fortunately there are wonderful cases like that, where people just rise to the occasion. And whatever you want, you can have. And they never lose. So whatever organ you give when you die, you will never lose. You'll always get. So whoever says that, if you give your, you know, your cornea, then you'll be blind in one eye. You know, if you give your heart, you won't have a heart, or you have heart problems, that doesn't happen. Whatever you give, you get back many, many times over. Lord, come. Any comments on that? I'm an organ donor, I've got my little card, it's in my room over there, so if I die you can have whatever you want. I wouldn't actually suggest having my nose because I get hay fever. Anything else you can have, it's not recommended. I wouldn't mind somebody else's nose though. So I always think that, you know, like a nose transplant would be very good. And just that, to be really ecumenical, it would be really good to have like a black nose. But maybe from an Aboriginal or somebody, because then you have a big black nose and a bit of a white face. I think that'd be really good. It really show you really are into multiculturalism. It'd be good fun, that, wouldn't it, having a black nose and a white face?
You're good with a Jewish nose, aren't you?
Jewish nose, yeah, okay. Dear Ajahn, this is the truth and the whole truth, nothing but the truth. Dear Ajahn, during last night's meditation, a mosquito came buzzing, and I thought, oh no, this is really irritating. But I remember Ajahn said, loving kindness, no ill will. I did good. So for the first time in my 50 years of life, I allowed the mosquito to feed on me. This morning I discovered not one, but 5 puncture marks on my knees. This morning, whilst meditating in the garden, you don't believe it, a bee came buzzing. I froze, a bee sting is a serious matter, I thought. Please go and find someone else. I have already donated my share of life. I've already donated my share of blood to the mosquito. Immediately I can hear you saying, no one will, so I pleaded, please leave me alone and give me a little space to do my meditation. I was given 30 minutes because then it was lunchtime. There you go, so the bee never stung you. That's very good. So, if you're really kind to the animals look after you. And even if you get 5 puncture marks on my wrist, they don't hurt that much. They don't disturb you as much as it's going to bite me, it's going to bite me, please don't bite me, please don't bite me, it's going to bite me, it's going to bite me, please don't bite me. All that worry and concern, that's much more disturbing. And actually the buzz of the mosquito is very, very soft. But the echo in your mind is very, very loud. Ajahn Brahm, please help! After samadhi meditation, I feel joy and happiness. I see brightness and full of energy. What should I do? Nothing. Enjoy. So, you don't need help. If things are going well. They'll say, what should I do next? And that's the wrong question. So, what should I do next? What should I do next? What you're doing now, that's good enough. So sometimes when we get somewhere, or we don't get somewhere, we always think, what should I do next? What should I do next? What should I do next? Do nothing next. It's what you're doing now. So just know what's happening now, enjoy it, and just allow it to happen. So, nature, just the way the mind will work, let the mind know what to do, and trust that mind, trust insight, and just enjoy, have fun. Especially now, just if you feel like meditating, carry on meditating, good samadhi, good joy, really get off on that, enjoy it as much as you can, you deserve it. When I learn meditation in Thailand, the technique I learn when thoughts or feelings arise is to label them. For example, say inside your head, hunger, 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 until it disappears. Also the interval monologue, rising, falling, with the breath. Sometimes I find myself doing this out of habit, particular labelling of thoughts and feelings that arise. What are your thoughts on this technique? And while on the subject, could you explain some of the major differences between the meditation you teach and the traditional vipassana? I guess I learned in Thailand. Thank you. Okay, that vipassana technique, it originated in Burma, and sometimes we call it Burmese vipassana, because it's not exactly the same as vipassana was taught in the suttas by the Buddha, but it sort of got that name. And it does do many, many things, and labelling is one of them. Labelling is all right at the beginning, but don't sort of get into that labelling too long. Otherwise it's just more and more thought, more and more commentary. And you miss the beauty of the silence. You can't get deep enough. So labelling can be okay at the beginning, but then let it go. Because the labels actually are not the thing itself. You get a feeling, once you label it hunger, 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 you actually make it hungry. Too much labelling, when we believe in the labels, we become the labels. You've all heard me say before that awful story about those two classes of children in the UK many years ago. So given the exam at the end of the year, and they never publish the results. They just assign the children to two different classes. The child who came top, together with the child who came fourth and fifth, eighth and ninth, 12th and 13th, went in one class. The child who came second and third, sixth and seventh, 10th and 11th, when in the other class. They split them up evenly. And they chose school teachers, who they thought were equally competent. They chose classrooms, which had equal facilities. They made everything absolutely equal, except for one thing. They called one class A, and the other one class B. That's all. They were equal ability. And for 1 year, some of those children went into class A. The parents said, I don't know how you did it, you've been so lazy, but you know, here's some extra pocket money, well done, keep it up. Other people in class B said, you know, you've done very bad in your exams, I'll take away your privileges, you can't sort of watch the TV so much. And the teachers taught them as if they were, the class A were better and the class B were worse. And after 1 year they gave the exam at the end of the year, school year. And the children in class A did just as you would expect if you had chosen the top half the year before. They became class A kids. And those in class B, it was nothing to do with their ability, they became class B kids. Teachers never expected very much, and never expected much of themselves. That label had stuck. I used to tell that story when I used to go into prisons and teach prisoners. You are not a criminal. You're a person who's done a criminal act, but you're not a criminal. If you say you're a criminal, you become a criminal and you never get out of this place. You go out for a while, you reoffend and come back again. You are not a criminal. That label, you become labels. That's the problem. If you say hunger, 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 then you become hungry. If you say feeling, 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 just don't give it a name. It's just a feeling, that's all. You don't associate with anything. Then all the time you're free. Too often, we give labels to things and we become those things. You're sick, you become the sick person. I'm paranoid, then you become the paranoid person. You become the label too often. someone tells you you're angry, or you've got sort of borderline personality disorder, and you become that. You live up to your labels. So, never label yourself. Are you a good meditator? Are you a hopeless meditator? You see, if you label yourself hopeless meditator, you'll never be able to succeed. If you label yourself as a good meditator, again you won't be able to succeed. Don't label at all. How can you label yourself? You do a good meditation, but you're not a good meditator. Understand? So that's the limitations of labels. So okay to begin with, but after a while just keep them alone. Dear Ash, look at this one. Are you enlightened? If not, where are your areas of identification?
So it's full in.
Let go. I'll let go of that one.
You're not the lecturer, is
it? He who knows doesn't say. He who says doesn't know. Whoever said that didn't know. I've been wondering something for some time, and I'm not sure if it has something to do with past lives or whether it means nothing. I've always felt relatively old, even when I was a child. I never really felt like a child. I've asked other people if they felt the same. Some say they do, others say no, and I do not know what I mean. Have you an explanation in regard to this in Buddhism? It's actually, when you really get into your meditation, you don't feel old or young. You feel like timeless. You know, that this mind is in a body which ages, but the mind just pretty much stays the same. Hopefully it gets wiser and more free as you live longer and longer. And that's why for some people it's hard to identify with age, especially the older you get. You know, so it's not just the wishful thinking, you know, I'm a young person in an old body, but that's actually, you know, you're just an ordinary person. You feel exactly the same in your mind, just the body just is different. So, it's an interesting experience then. If you had that experience when you were very young, it is probably just, you know, you've got very good memories of a past life which has stayed in there, you know, the old person before you were born. And that's, you're attached to that, you know, clinging on to that, and that's the perception you've carried on. You've carried through all these years, and all being. So it's interesting, if you have that perception then, get into your nice meditation, get very deep and see if you can remember your past lives and understand why you thought you were an old being.
I think that's interesting. Now, people who don't develop insight through their lives, they oftentimes grow old physically but have an idea of themselves in their mind that they're still 18 or 19 or 17.
Who's that? Sorry, that's...
The people who don't develop insight in their lives. They oftentimes will have a body of 70, but they'll be emotionally aged 15.
Yes, right.
And so they ask, if you ask them, how do you feel? And they'll say, oh, I've just been feeling the same way for the last 40 years.
Yeah.
So it's going the opposite of what the person was saying.
Indeed. But if one develops the insight and the freedom and know the difference between the mind and the body, then you can understand what I was saying. The mind is one thing, the body is another thing. And the body does age, but the mind just grows. It can sort of stagnate too. But that's really just how you use your time here. So, how old are you? How many years have you got left? I know this. You've got many hours left before this meditation retreat finishes. So, now is the time, the honeymoon period is over. Now is the time to enjoy this retreat. When you think of sleeping, remember, you can sleep as long as you like when you're in your coffin. But now you're alive. Now you're alive, enjoy the moment. And see if you can use all the power of what you've done today to get into deep meditation. If you get into deep meditation, don't do anything. Allow it to happen. Don't think, what should I do next? That's the wrong question. Shh, be quiet. Don't disturb the process. We always want to be in control. We always want to know what to do next. And I'm not telling you, because you should put more attention on what you're doing now. Next, allow that to happen when it happens. Now is the most important time. That's easy. So, thank you for all those questions. I've gone over time a little bit this evening. But it's not my fault. It's your fault.